Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend's edition. We're going to start off in the first half of the show discussing market moves, the opportunities that investors could have within some of the sectors that continue to perform quite well, a number of opportunities in the markets, as well as touch on rates, which continue to fall in the U.S. dollar, looking at that 100 level on the dollar index. In the back half of the show, we're going to switch to the energy sector again, which unfortunately has been a little boring, but there still could be some opportunities there as the oil price has generally faded, but still is very much within a range. We are kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, that is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, you can check out the In the Know Trader website. I will post a link in the show notes to that site, which Rick has three products, a monthly report called the 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P, a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report, and a daily report called the Daily Tips Sheet. Rick, let's start off with broadly, the last time we chatted was mid to late July. That was before the yen carry trade sell-off day and even the couple days of weakness before that, which had a lot of investors, I think, a lot more fearful of a larger market correction. Turned out that after that Monday on that yen carry trade sell-off, boy, oh boy, that was a definite buy the dip opportunity, because look at how much these markets have ripped back. Rick, give us a little recap of how you traded around that time and your thoughts on the stability of this market after that pretty quick drop, but then rebound.
So, Corey, I did nothing that day, actually didn't buy or sell, but what I was waiting to see was whether, you know, how much the damage was and what was the reaction. And by 3 days afterwards, I was already in print telling my clients no technical damage was done based upon the models I look at. And as the bulk of the models I look at are not what most people look at. And because of that, as compared to virtually anyone who's, let's say, technically oriented, who's been interviewed on business television and radio networks since then, who were all selling into the rally, 3 days after August 5th, I told my clients, no technical damage done by the market. And the best way, and what I did as kind of a hedged trade, just because if you got another round of, you know, the unwind of the carry, the market could come off again. What we did was we went, my recommendation was go long the MAGS ETF, that's the MAG7, M-A-G-S, and short the RSP, the S&P equal weight, the S&P 500 equal weight ETF against it. And we just finished taking that off yesterday. And it doesn't mean it can't go higher, but what we did is we made, I think, about 4.3% in a hedge trade by essentially buying the top end of the risk market, but having it hedged. Because when you get events like that, to simply have bought without having some hedge certainly would have done better, but in 40 years in this business, to me, the smart way to play something like that is to have a hedge trade that goes, if the idea is right, you're going to make money, but you'll give up some upside to be protected in case you got another headline like you did, and all of a sudden the market's, you know, down again, huge amounts. The net after effect is that yesterday, well, let's go back to today's Friday. So Wednesday marked a DeMarc setup 9 count that filled the last upside gap made one day after the market made its all-time high. Then yesterday marked a sequential upside exhaustion signal, also a DeMarc indicator. Those two combined showing up a day apart. No surprise that yesterday went from an up day to a decent down day. You've got institutional traders who sold into the rally at that point to lock some profits, and I think smartly so, going into Powell's comments earlier today. You never know what the Fed chairman is going to say. You never know if something comes out of left field. Not a bad idea to take some money off the table. So despite the fact that the market was up decently this morning, is now barely up 0.5%. And people are settling into the fact that we could be still again close to a near-term top. And I'm generally in favor of buying the dips because the same time that I came back and said that no technical damage was done, I also reiterated the long-term upside target for the S&P, which is just north of 6,100. And I do think we get there in this general bull cycle. That doesn't mean we can't sell off on some news. It doesn't mean in kind of what I would suggest would be a worst case scenario for some reason that right now I wouldn't know what the catalyst would be. But it does mean in some crazy way, we don't potentially have a trading range with a double top near what was the previous all-time high. And much of what we saw into the August 5th low, it's very possible that you give back a heck of a lot of the rally. But in the bigger picture, I think nothing was done to damage the charts and that we're still headed for just north of 6,100 in this bull market that started back in October of 2022 on a secular basis. And then got the cyclical low in October 23.
All right, Rick, so you still think there's some upside in the S&P up to that 6,100 level. It's interesting that when you did the pair trade, the hedge trade, that you shorted the equal weight index. What does that say about the market breadth for the rest of the S&P 493 versus the Magnificent Seven? Do you still expect the mega cap tech stocks to keep outperforming? Is there any catch-up trade potential in that move to 6,100 in some of the other areas of the market?
I don't mind kind of reducing that exposure because right in here, the same way that the S&P kind of went 9 days in a row and closed above its closing price from 4 days prior, which is a particular pattern, part of this DeMarc model, the spread, the ratio of the Mag 7 names versus the equal weighted S&P did the same thing. And it's often a turning point. It doesn't have to be a major turning point, but for the near term, I'm very comfortable having taken this off, unwound the trade yesterday, and I'll watch to see now. If it starts heading back up higher in favor of Mag 7 names, then I may very well put it on again. But I think that for the time being, you want to still have exposure to Mag 7, but pay attention, and a lot of individual investors are not in the mindset of doing this, but I think you need to be looking at how the Mag 7 does against equal weighted S&P, standard S&P, to get a sense of when and if you start getting some type of upside exhaustion of the mega cap names, those seven names versus the rest of the market. So because yesterday had a signal that it could be a near-term high and potentially even more than a near-term high, I think personally, it was a great trade to come back on the long side to get my clients long. There's only one short trade I put on since that drop, and I didn't put it on until the market had rallied decently. And when we ended up losing on that particular trade off of my daily tip sheet, which puts out 3 to 4 new ideas a week, we lost just, I think it was 2.2%. Something like that. So a very respectable loss versus some of the other names that, I mean, since August 5th, I think we're probably up over 20% in the trading account on the daily tip sheet, just having had 95% of all the trades be on the long side and catching some. We got long Dell at 99, it kicked the bulk of it out at 110. So there's 10% in a trade. I still have a quarter left of that. We went long silver miners. But, you know, since just in the few weeks since August 5th low, I've been predominantly long and saw the reason to be a buyer versus most technical oriented people who've been selling into the rally.
Oh man, people got scared from that fall. But hey, even today, to your point, the markets did open up on the day, but the VIX was also up over 15%. So a bit of a dichotomy there. Let's filter down to the rate environment. Because the last time we chatted, again, about a month ago, you outlined critical support of the 10-year right around 4.13%. Well, clearly that's been broken because the 10-year is now down below 3.8%. This is all tying into more rate cut expectations. Rick, where do you see rates going from here?
So we had bought bonds this year at the two peaks, precisely on the days of the two peaks, 4.72% and 4.6%. And the cover, we actually got out on the morning of August 5th. In my weekend institutional report, which you guys get, I had said the trading bottom would be at 3.68. Well, what was low on August 5th? 3.67. By one basis point, we essentially covered one tick from the low. And with the bigger picture, still with a measurement down to 3.53%, as a potential longer term, or actually I'll call it at this point, I'll say it's a medium term target, all measured off of the 5% high. So 3.53 has been the big target off of the 5% high since we've made that. But from a more short to medium term basis, I told my clients 3.68 is the best you're going to get right now. It worked well. Rates are in the low 3.8s now. And I actually sent out a special report to one of my very large institutional clients that's a pure fixed income place and told them yesterday that I think barring Powell screwing up what the market has already built in, and he didn't do that today at all, I actually think rates could get up above the 4.02 high that they've made since that 3.67 low and get to like 4.05 to 4.09. Fill the gap there, and then you're going to start getting into the major resistance again that starts at 4.13 and goes all the way up to 4.28%. So I am much more in favor of tactically playing bonds now than strategically playing them. The bulk of the down move in yields has been met, and I think you're much better off for those who have the talent to trade that market as compared to simply positioning yourself for significantly lower rates, given that we've really seen, I think, a dramatic drop. When you think about 5%, the peak at 5% went to 3.79. That's 121 basis point move. From 3.79, we got as high as, I think it was 4.64. And that's when we bought again at 4.6. And so take away 121 basis points from 4.64, the same. So to have equal moves down measured from that 5% high, you get 3.53. So the fact that we got into the 3.6s, I'm not going to be a pig to try to get those last 15 basis points. And I had a reason to buy a 3.68. And obviously that was to cover a 3.68 and in yield terms. And I think it's the right thing. So in general, no, I don't think rates are materially moving higher. But from just the normal back and forth of how markets work and the general belief that rates are going lower, I think you've got enough people believing that. You now have a Fed chairman who all but said it today. Of course, he didn't quite say it, but he's like, we're ready now. We're, you know, the signals are lined up. We're just waiting for some further confirmation. So, you know, the first week in September, you're going to get the unemployment report, and that'll be a big thing. But my guess is the market coming into today had a 75% chance, based on Fed fund futures, that the Fed was going to cut 25 bips in September, and a 25% chance that they would cut 50 bips now. I'm not in front of my screens now, so I don't know where that is. Let's put it this way. He didn't say anything to change my scenario to think that right now, tactically, yields probably move higher and take out that 4.02 high just to squeeze those who were playing against that level and we push up towards that unfilled gap and maybe play with that 413 level again, which is where we broke down from.
All right, Rick. So like you said, tactically, you're looking for rates to maybe jump up a little bit, especially with everybody leaning towards rates going down. Maybe that catches some people off sides, but then eventually you do see it going back down again, the rates. I was going to ask you, with so much of the anticipation of the Fed rate hike already being priced in interest rates and them really doing the job of the Fed months ahead of time, because the Fed still hasn't even done their first cut yet, do you see that maybe most of that is already priced in, providing we get this little jump up and maybe it goes back down? Most of the move is over now as far as rates going down, because we saw the bond market go on a 40-year rip from 1980 all the way to 2020, where interest rates got down to 0.4%. And now a lot of people believe we're in a structural situation where bonds and may keep selling off and where rates may keep going up for decades. How do you look at it from the longer time frame as far as the bond market?
I think that that 40 basis point secular low will be the low, will not be challenged. And that in the big, big picture, for those people who own bonds in their portfolios, ultimately, you're probably going to want to sell those, because any sense of a return to equilibrium pricing, 50-year pricing, 80-year pricing, just long-term means rates are going to go up. So could we stay down at something in the 3% range, even get into the upper twos? Sure. Do I think we're going to under 2.5%? I don't. And we could stay in this range for years, but I think we're done. That 40-year bull market is done, and it's just a matter of finding places in which, for those people who own bonds, ultimately you want to sell out of them. The 40-year bull market that you talk about provided incredible returns for investors from that 1980 to 2020 period, because the value of their bonds went up so much on top of whatever yield they were getting. Now, if you bought bonds in 1980 and you locked in 15% on a 10-year, it was phenomenal. If you bought bonds in 2020, you unfortunately made virtually nothing and got your rear end handed to you because the price of the bond fell so much. Obviously, elderly people tend to own bonds as a decent part of their portfolio as compared to aggressively being in stocks. If you're a 30 or 40-year-old, you shouldn't own bonds. You should own, and I tell my kids this all the time, go into the most aggressive growth. For your 401ks that your companies offer you, go into the most aggressive growth names and ETFs, whatever, mutual funds, whatever is offered. And I don't care what the market does, just max out your 401k contribution every year and just buy the most aggressive you can. Because if you're a 30-year-old and you're not going to touch this money for 40 years or more, there's nothing that's going to be growth in the stock market over time. Certainly bonds will not. And if you're in that age category, that's what you do. If you're a 60-year-old or a 70-year-old and you're kind of in the latter part of that phase of income in your life and some are retired, sure, you generally want to own bonds for the guaranteed return. But if we get down towards 3%, let's say in the 10-year, I'm not going to tell you that you really want to be locking in 3% for 10 years, because the likelihood is that it's just a matter of time before rates ultimately start moving up in the bigger picture of return to equilibrium. Long-term treasury pricing on a 10-year is probably closer to 6, 7, 8% than it is to the current 3.6%, where 3.8 where we are now. And if they go lower, I only see that as likely losing money over time, because the value of those bonds will decrease. So I would, at that point, I would say, if you are in that kind of typical age group where a financial advisor would typically say you want to be 30, 40% or more in bonds, I would say thank you very much, but no, I will be in very short-term instruments rather than locking in 10 years to make, let's say, theoretically 3 or 3.25. I think that's going to be a losing trade for you over time. That 3% that you get will not offset the value of the bonds that will likely decrease on you.
Interesting. What a different bond market and world we are living in. Let's move over to the US dollar, because that's been moving down really ever since mid to late April, now closing in on that 100 level on the dollar index. Last time it was here was in December of last year and very briefly July of last year. But below 100, we really have to go back to early 2022 when the dollar was rising. Rick, how important is this 100 level on the dollar index? And do you think that the dollar is in a new trend that could just continue lower?
It certainly could, Corey. But here's the caveat. By and large, in this cycle that we're in, generally, the dollar has moved with rates. Not day after day. It doesn't have a correlation of 1.0, which means they completely move together. However, in general, rates and the dollar have been similar. Has something changed in the last few weeks? The only thing that's potentially changed, and I don't have enough information on this yet to believe it's actually happening, but there's some little chatter on the street that hedge funds, rather than being short the yen now, are switching to short the dollar and use the money that they do by selling dollars to buy other instruments in higher yielding places. If that's true, that will be continued pressure on the dollar in general. In the near term, if I'm right that rates are going back over 4%, then I think those who are traders look to buy the dollar, even potentially today or Monday, and look for a quick pop in the dollar. So I don't see the dollar index going to 95 if the U.S. 10-year hangs around 4. If the U.S. 10-year gets to 3.25, that's a different story.
Well, Rick, what does that mean for gold then? Because gold tends to react to interest rates and the dollar. If there's kind of a dichotomy between rates and the dollar right now in the short term, what's your short-term outlook and maybe medium-term outlook on the yellow metal?
So gold is, I've owned gold for years, and I'm actually wrote clients within the last week or so that I think gold is getting close to a tradable top, enough so that it's going to be worth selling out of some of my gold. So I may very well in the next few weeks sell out of a third or more of gold that I've held for 10 years, or forget when I first started buying gold, but I have good, these are going to be capital gains, and some of it's in my retirement account, but some of it's not, and I got to figure out which one I want to sell from. But I do think we're probably closer to some near-term top in gold, which would also imply at some degree some type of bounce coming in the dollar. If the dollar's going down to 95, then gold is not close to its top. If the dollar is somewhat near bottom, I could make the case that gold could have, I would say, let me think, at the current price, so 10% is what, two in the neighborhoods of $250, give or take. Yeah, I could see a potential 10% drop in gold. So that doesn't destroy the charts or anything, but, you know, 10%, it questions now the longer term picture of just how much higher gold will go in this cycle.
Hey, gold has been on an absolute tear along with some of the markets, but gold just keeps on breaking out to some all-time highs. But yeah, if interest rates, if the dollar start to move in the opposite direction, could put a little headwind into that rally. Rick, we're out of time here. Thank you very much for taking time with us on this weekend show. Always find it interesting to view how you're viewing the markets and how you are trading them. Again, Rick is the president of Vencing Your Investment Strategies. I will post a link to the In the Know Trader website in our show notes. That's where you can find all of Rick's retail and individual investment products. Rick, thanks again for your time on this weekend show.
Thanks, guys, for having me. Always appreciate the time.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more,
follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.